Here's a bedtime story for you, Spokane, and it's an important one to keep in mind. The word egregore was first coined by French poet Victor Hugo in 1859, but the concept is as old as human society, and that is very, very old. Egregore means different things to different people, but it's in its ancient non-linguistic meaning. It refers to the collective and ongoing spirituality of a place that both links all periods of times and all beings who have ever lived there, plant, animal, and perhaps even mineral, and at the same time transcends them as a collective unity. The old Hermetic orders and Rosicrucians were familiar with this concept, so are 21st century scientists as they explore deeper revelations of quantum physics and to the fact that matter is neither created nor destroyed, but ever changes form and retains its collective spiritual essence. The city of Spokane is very old, and its egregore extends back millions of years, years when volcanoes and ice sheets and cataclysmic floods swept our home, and long before the arrival of humans in this area. Anthropologists say that there have been humans living in the area we now call the Spokane Falls for 12,000 years, and some of the oldest evidence of human habitation in North America has been found not too far from us. In Spokane, we were all products of immigration, and no group of people or any nation could lay claim to the entirety of the spiritual egregore of our ancient city. About 1,000 years ago, a new group of immigrants, today called the Interior Salish people, moved into the area. But from what direction and for what reason is unknown. In our area, the Salish called themselves the Spokane, the children of the sun, and there were the Upper Spokanes, or Sentaohla, in Spokane Valley to the east, and the Middle Spokanes, or Sinohomenish, at the north of the falls. The Lower Spokanes were a 2 or 3 days journey to the west and did not play a critical role in the history of the city. There were problems with competing groups over many centuries. The Algonquin Blackfeet or Niitsitapi people were very territorial and violent and occupied northwest Montana just over the Better Root Mountains where the bison were. To hunt the bison first meant hunting parties had to first confront the Blackfoot, often with the losses of loved ones and friends. Until the late 18th century, the Spokanes had to contend with the great Shoshone Empire, which dominated most of the non-coastal inland western United States for hundreds of years. All empires fade eventually. And in the late 18th century, waves of two related groups of Plateau Penutian people from California and Oregon, the Sahaptian, Yakima Nation, and the Nimipu, who we call the Nez Perce, conquered southeastern Washington, driving the Shoshone into the mountains. The Nez Perce would remain hostile to the Spokanes, perhaps a bit even to the present day, but the closer Sahaptian Yakimas would interact and intermarry with the Spokanes and carry great influence with the Interior Salish of the Falls. Then in 1855, the army of a new empire appeared in eastern Washington and began a new invasion north of the Columbia and Snake Rivers, neutralizing first the Nez Perce, who would become its allies until 1877, and then violently confronting the Yakima Nation to the south of Spokane. With the invasion in the ensuing 3-year struggle, which we call the Great Yakima War, the Upper Spokane, Sentaohla, and the Middle Spokanes of the Falls would be drawn into the conflict and eventually be ruthlessly slaughtered, and their villages, crops, and nearly 1,000 of their horses destroyed. Devastation would reign in the community by the Spokane Falls, followed by occupation and oppression by the conquerors, with banishment of nearly all Upper and Middle Spokane people in 1887. Volcanoes, ice ages, floods, immigrant settlements, and wave upon wave of violent invasions. This is the ongoing and ever-building egregore of the city of Spokane. The entire history of this place by the falls, it's our history. regardless of the group or race or cultural affiliation each of us believe we came from. Each group of immigrants or invaders had its own version of history, but the spiritual entirety of Spokane's history, it's our history, and we cannot divorce the good from the bad or the human from the inhuman. Good evening, Spokane. My name is Victor Komorowski. Before you tuck yourself into bed tonight, consider the city's greatest social crisis and crossroads of morality, the Great Yakima War. Even prior to the appearance of a new invading empire in the 19th century, the Children of the Sun living at the Spokane Falls suffered tragedy. In 1520, the deadly epidemic of smallpox first reached the shores of Mexico, brought by the Spanish invaders from Europe, and although it took 250 years, person to person, village to village, tribe to tribe, and nation to nation, it finally arrived in eastern Washington by the Spokane Falls. In 1778, the mysterious and deadly disease of the white man appeared in Spokane. They have killed 3/4 to 2/3 of the entire population of the collective interior Salish tribes in Washington, and in Spokane, it was an unequaled plague. Striking especially young women and children, the Children of the Sun were in serious danger of becoming extinct. Replenishment of their local tribes was of unequaled concern, and even intermarriage with the usually friendly Yakimas to the south was frowned upon. Religion took on a re-emphasized meaning with the people looking into their personal and tribal spirits for guidance at the annual ghost dance following the winter solstice, usually on high ground and very probably at the sacred springs we now refer to as Drumheller Park in Spokane. Then in the year 1799, the volcano today called Mount St. Helens erupted 350 miles southwest of the falls. There were earthquakes with raining pumice dust the local people called gray rain for 4 days. It was an ecological disaster with local wild food crops and game animals destroyed. Starvation ensued. There was serious need to participate in the New Year's ghost dance in a meaningful way. With this heavy history still on the hearts of the ghost dancers in that gathering at Drumheller Springs Park in January 1800, during one memorable evening that will be forever echoed in even the basalt stones and whispered in the seeping spring waters of the place, an old man, the great prophet Uriakin, stood up at that huge council fire. Uriakin, meaning circling raven. He didn't often speak, but when he did, he commanded the attention of all present. When the drum beating and chanting stopped in deference to and respect for the elder prophet, what the assembled tribesmen and tribeswomen heard was terrifying. "My brothers and sisters," Uriakin stated loudly for all to hear, "I have just been told by our grandmothers and grandfathers and the animal ghost spirits who are our ancestral guardians, that the great dark disasters we have suffered, the dying out disease and the gray snow, these are just 2 of 3 disasters which are to strike our people. And the third disaster to come will result in the destruction of our people, our country, and our way of life. The third disaster to come will be an army of white ghosts who will descend on our land, bringing death and destruction." The prophecy of the great Uriakin struck the interior Salish to the heart, and the prophecy was taken quite seriously. For 3 generations, the prophecy was handed down mother to daughter and grandmother to granddaughter. With the prophecy unfulfilled, white explorers from 2 competing empires, Great Britain and the United States, both claimed interior Salish and Yakima territory, and in 1818, they staved off a war between the two of them by agreeing that they would both be allowed to colonize these vast lands, to be divided between themselves at a later date. To dissuade settlements by the Americans, the Canadian Hudson's Bay Company sent hunters into the Northwest to indiscriminately kill as many wild animals as they could find in a massive slaughter, equaled only by the near extinction of the American bison in the 1870s, to starve the Plains Indians. After 1846, the United States claimed all of the interior Salish and Yakima national lands for itself and began establishing military forts along the lower Columbia River at the Dalles and Walla Walla. Gold was discovered in what is today Spokane County in 1850, which sent waves of Caucasian and Chinese miners into eastern Washington and caused a great deal of stress among the tribes. Miners sometimes assaulted local women, and they were killed in retaliation. The Yakima Confederation was on the leading edge of the confrontations with both the miners and the United States Army, and several great war chiefs arose in the 1850s, including Chief Moses of the Columbias, Qualchan, Kamiakin, and his wife Colesta. Among the Spokanes, Chief Slough Ketcha, known later as Spokane Gary, had been a spiritual leader and chief of the Upper and Middle Spokane since 1831. When he had escaped from a Hudson's Bay settlement at Fort Garry in Alberta along the Red River. To the east of the falls, Chief Andrew Celtis of the Coeur d'Alenes, or the Shishumish people, came to prominence. It should be noted at this point that in the centuries before the Yakima War, the interior Salish had been both matrilineal and matriarchal, and so had most of the Western peoples in North America prior to the collapse of the Mississippian culture along the southeast of the Mississippi River in the year 1400. This meant that young women as well as men went on vision quests, were trained and fought as warriors, and socially held positions of respect and leadership. Interior Salish Yakima Confederation war parties included women, and the most famous to present memory was Colesta, wife of Chief Kamiakin. She herself was a chief, a shaman, and a warrior who fought alongside her husband with her signature weapon, a war club with a long handle. For political favors granted in the presidential election of 1852, a Franklin Pierce sycophant by the name of Isaac Stevens was appointed governor of the newly created Washington Territory, as well as superintendent of Indian affairs for the region, on March 17, 1853. There could have scarcely been a less appropriate choice for the appointments. Standing 5'3" with his boots on, Stevens had an inferiority complex exhibited by an extremely aggressive and domineering personality with an antisocial traits, if any, historians, even the most jingoistic, choose to defend today. He came to Washington Territory with a personal agenda to eliminate or neutralize all indigenous people in the territory and confiscate their nation's lands. He had some Confederates among the Native Americans in eastern Washington. The Nez Perce had declared themselves as allies of the United States and would remain so until they themselves were banished to reservations in 1877. The Nez Perce would supply scouts, warriors, and translators to the U.S. Army in the Yakima War. In Spokane Valley, at a place today called Plant's Ferry Park, Antoine Plant was a locally hated part French and part Blackfoot trader who had no use for the Spokanes or the Coeur d'Alenes, and he would become a safe haven for the U.S. Army and a source of supplies and information during the Yakima War. In November 1855, Territorial Governor Stevens arrived in Spokane and organized an armed militia force of miners he named the Stevens Guards, who, with another local militia named the Spokane Invincibles, constructed a stone blockhouse at Antoine Plant's ferry as a base of operations against the local people. On December 4, 1855, Stevens called a meeting of local Confederation chiefs and brazenly told them to sell their land to the U.S. government and move into reservations as the Nez Perce had agreed to do, or so he said. It is at that meeting that Chief Slough Ketcha, or Spokane Gary, famously told the governor that while he considered his people inferior because of the color of their skin, he was almost certain that when the invaders were cut with their knives, they would bleed the same color red as everyone else. Stevens was warned by the chiefs and even their Jesuit priest spiritual advisors, Father Josette and Rivali, that if the U.S. Army moved north of the Columbia River to the south of Spokane, there would be serious consequences. With Governor Stevens' agitation and encouragement, his militias and the U.S. Army moved closer to war and an invasion of eastern Washington. The U.S. Army began preliminary steps toward building the military road, later to be called the Mullen Road, to link Fort Benton, Montana, at the Great Falls of the Missouri, through eastern Washington Territory to Fort Walla Walla to facilitate the movement of troops into the area. Then on May 6, 1858, Major Edward Steptoe of the U.S. 9th Infantry, stationed in Fort Walla Walla, crossed the Columbia and Snake Rivers and marched northward with five companies of infantry and cavalry, five officers and two cannons in several ill-defined goals, among which were to harass the Native Americans and exercise his troops after a long winter. 30 miles south of the present city of Spokane, Major Steptoe's force of about 160 men were stopped by several hundred Spokane and Coeur d'Alene warriors, along with Yakima War Chief Kamiakin, Chief Spokane Gary, and Jesuit priest Josette. Convinced to retreat by the overwhelming force, the military column withdrew to the present town of Rosalia, when careless shots rang out and a general battle ensued. The military suffered an ignominious defeat, with the loss of two officers, 19 other casualties, and the deaths of most of their Nez Perce scouts. In the uncontrolled retreat, Major Steptoe abandoned cannons, ammunition, horses, and supplies, and at least one injured trooper left to die along the way. Back at Fort Walla Walla, Major Steptoe was promoted to lieutenant colonel, and the Washington, D.C. politicians both vowed revenge upon the Spokanes and the Coeur d'Alenes and introduced a bill in Congress banning Jesuit missionaries from evermore having any contact with Native Americans. That bill failed. Artillery, ammunition, fresh troops from the east, and rifled weapons poured into Fort Dalles on the Columbia River, headquarters of Colonel George Wright's 9th Infantry. After transferring men, horses, cannons, and equipment to Fort Walla Walla on August 27, 1858, Colonel Wright set out with a force of 190 cavalry, 400 artillery and cannon troops, 290 infantry and auxiliaries, and a force of 30 Nez Perce scouts toward the north. A ready force of 700 fighting men with support troops. Word spread of the invasion, and warriors from the middle and upper Spokanes, Coeur d'Alene, Yakima, Kalispell, Ponderay, Colville, Columbias, Okanagans, and even some disaffected Nez Perce, all gathered at the Spokane Falls. Chiefs Qualchan, Kamiakin, and Gary were prominent among the warriors. On September 1, 1858, at a place called Four Lakes, 10 miles southwest of Spokane, near the present-day Cheney exit from Interstate 90, a general engagement between the U.S. military and the Yakima Confederation ensued. With cannons blazing and flanked by significant cavalry, it was a significant victory for the United States soldiers. A brazen memorial at the site commemorates the battle with these words. Quote, "On this historic ground, September 1, 1858, 700 soldiers under Colonel George Wright, USA, routed 5,000 Allied Indians. 4 days later, the rallied hostiles were decisively defeated in a running battle. They sued for mercy and have ever since maintained lasting peace." End quote. Perhaps the inscription is even more than a bit of bravado from the victorious than the truth. That night after this first disastrous battle, council fires blazed around Spokane, including throughout the high place of Drumheller Springs. Around the council fires in Spokane following the Battle of Four Lakes, many elders advised the young warriors not to return to the battlefield with the whites. It was wisdom to realize that the sheer numbers of the soldiers, their superior rifles, and their barking cannons would spell a complete disaster for all who dared to oppose them a second time. Surrender and throwing themselves on the mercy of the soldiers seemed the only logical course of action. However, on this solemn occasion, it was the young warriors whose voices were heard, and whose voices were heard most convincingly. The warriors reminded their elders of the prophecy they, their parents, and their grandparents had heard since the time the great Uriachin had stood up in council not far from the place where they pondered their fate even then. The third great disaster of the interior Salish people had yet to come to fulfillment, but come it must. It was their great and ancient people's destiny. They would have to oppose the army of White Ghost regardless of the outcome, and regardless of an outcome everyone already knew was certain. On the morning of September 5, 1858, as George Wright's 9th Infantry advanced up out of the Latah Creek Valley and onto the Spokane Plains just west of the modern city, it was met by a line of thousands of interior Salish and Yakima warriors, men and women, from Confederated tribes all over what is now eastern Washington. One of the soldiers of the 9th Infantry wrote in his diary after the battle that the array of the native warriors had been a fantastic sight to see. Brilliant war paint and feathers had covered the warriors, their weapons, and even their war horses, and they were incredibly brave warriors prepared to die. That was true and obvious. But what was not obvious to the soldiers of the 9th Infantry was that the warriors were also dressed for their funeral, and a date with destiny for their people and their tribes that they had known about since that fateful evening in 1800 when the great Uriachin had prophesied. The young warriors had come to charge the cannons, but they had also come to their funerals. In the battle that followed, the cannons roared, and 6 hours later, as many as 1,800 interior Salish and Yakima warriors lay dead on the field of battle. The dead warriors may have been the lucky ones, as George Wright followed up and led his army of White Ghosts all through this area, burning entire villages, destroying crops, and shooting and hanging those warriors he could find. Even children and the elderly were not spared. That winter without food or provisions would prove deadly to most of the remaining civilians, especially the surviving very young and elderly. Colonel George Wright continued operations in the Spokane Valley east of the present-day city near the Idaho border. In his written report of activities, he stated, quote, "The chastisement which these Indians received has been severe but well-merited and absolutely necessary to impress them with our power. For the last 80 miles, our route has been marked by slaughter and devastation. 900 horses and a large number of cattle have been killed or appropriated for our own use. Many horse with large quantities of wheat and oats, also many catches of vegetables, and dried berries have been destroyed. A blow has been struck which they will never forget." End quote. The so-called chastisement which was dealt out to the Native Americans earned Colonel and later General Wright a dark legacy of ignominy among the generations of Spokane citizens and visitors. Upon the promise of Colonel Wright to honor delegations of warring chiefs to discuss terms of peace under a flag of truce, when a truce delegation of 7 chiefs, led by Chief Qualchon and his warrior wife, arrived at the military encampment on Latah Creek, 25 miles south of Spokane, on September 24, 1858, the peace delegates were immediately seized by the Federals and hanged by order of Colonel Wright. He would hang 10 others in the days to come, some under flags of truce. Following these shameful executions, Colonel Wright cynically took a pen and crossed out the name Latah Creek on his military maps and wrote above the crossed out names Hangman's Creek. This dishonorable and shameful legacy would continue to this very day, despite many objections from state, county, and city of Spokane officials. Thanks to the Spokane City Council, who in 2017 renamed Canada Island in downtown Spokane Sinhumana Island, or Salmon People in the Salish language, in honor of our brothers and sisters who occupied our city for a millennium and suffered so grievously at the hands of the White Ghost from the South. The history, the happy but dark and even very dark history of this place is our history, and a part of the egregore of Spokane we cannot and dare not ignore. May we never forget it. Good night, Spokaneites.